Well, yeah. I mean, we should be super excited. We should be like, hey, this is awesome. But the hype cycle for, like, after ChatGPT, GPT-3.5, like, got people's attention. And then GPT-4 was like, what just happened to us? And for me, like, it just opened up just whole new ways of thinking about things.
That is Mike Topolovich, Salesforce architect. I'm Josh Burke, your host for the Salesforce Developer Podcast. And here in the podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with Mike about a wide range of topics, especially, however, the role of architects in the Salesforce ecosystem. But we are going to kick right back off to, as we often do, with his early years.
I don't know if I always wanted to get into it, but yeah, I just kind of got into it. Yeah, I was 5-6 years old. I remember there was, you know, Christmas morning at grandma and grandpa's house, and I got a computer. I got a Commodore VIC 20.
Ooh,
had
nice.
You know, 20 kilobytes of RAM at the time. Uh-huh. Not 20 megabytes, not 20 gigabytes, 20 kilobytes. Uh-huh. And I had my uncle Eric was a tow truck driver and decided one day that he had higher aspirations in life. So he would go to school at night to learn how to essentially write BASIC. I don't know what he learned on, but It was TI BASIC or whatever. But he taught me TI 99 BASIC. So that was my first programming language. And if you think of, you know, Trailhead and how people are going back and learning tech skills later in life, this was, you know, this was the model for that. He went back and Learned how to code, taught me how to code at a very early age. And, you know, by the second grade, I was writing like Math Blaster programs for my second grade class. So computers found me. They've always been a part of what I do. But In terms of, you know, actually wanting to do stuff with computers, I've always been more interested in what you can do with computers. Like, how do we use these things to make our lives better? So that aspect of the technology to me has always been fascinating. But, you know, computers are the tool. They're the means to the end.
Right. Fun fact, I almost didn't get into computing because when I first started, quote unquote, programming, all I wanted to do was like, put in the maze game that they had, you know, but remember, like, I think it was like Computer World or something like that. And it was like, put this code into your, you know, compiler and you have a fun little game. And it's like, I didn't even know what a syntax error meant at the time. Right. And like, but I got a lot of them and was so annoyed by the experience that by the time I went back to like Logo, I think was my first college programming language. I was like, I don't know if I want to do this. And now it's,
I learned the same way. Yeah. I mean, it was for me, it was Family Computing was the magazine. And it was early 80s, but it was kind of like general BASIC. So it was supposed to work on, you know, Apple BASIC, Commodore BASIC, whatever, but it was the same thing. Like I would get into it. I would write like 100 lines of BASIC code, like, you know, 20 go to 10. And at the end, it wouldn't work. Like you go to run your program, it wouldn't work. I would have no idea what was going on. So it was the same thing. Like I was memorizing syntax without understanding what was going on, but through just doing that and reverse engineering computer programs, really, really early computer programs, I kind of got into the minds of the people who wrote those programs and just kind of figured out, okay, well, this is what they intended this language or, you know, this is what this is supposed to be used for. I figured out the best ways to use it, apply that. And even back then, that's how I learned to code was, why did the programmer do this? Oh, because they want you to input something. They're going to process that input and it's going to provide an output somewhere else. It was just kind of breaking things down into process and then figuring out how to apply, you know, some level of automation to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to keep on this thread, it's like my failures, I think most of that was on a Commodore 64. But I learned how to type. Like I got really good at typing because eventually I realized that was my problem was I kept putting things in manually that was incorrect.
Sitting there pecking with your two index fingers.
Exactly. And so later in, I think it was either junior high or high school, all blends together at this point. One of the best things, one of the best things that I think any teacher has ever told me, so we're in a computer lab class and it's all Apple IIs and you know the old green screens and stuff like that. And he said, now, I just want you to remember there's nothing you can do that's going to harm these computers. And so if you get done with an exercise and you want to go take it apart and put it back together again, there's nothing you can do that's going to harm these computers. It gave me this sense of freedom, right? Like, okay, once I did the homework, I don't have to do the homework anymore. If I want to see what happens if I do a go-to line 4 million times in a row, I'll get it. I think I did that. Yeah. Who wants to see that? But anyway, it was kind of comforting to know that even though I could make mistakes, like I could do no harm, yeah, kind of thing. And I think that really did. That was when I was like, okay, code can be playful. Like you can go in and break it, take it back apart again, put it back together again, and then see what happens.
Well, and when you break it is when you learn stuff. When you have the unintended consequences, when you have an exception, you know, like we have today, when an exception is raised that you didn't expect, you learn something about the behavior of your code. Back then, it was just, you know, something, it spit out some compiler code and you had to figure out what that meant, but it taught you something, right? That's how we learn because, you know, just in the Salesforce space, I think a lot of developers who are getting into the space struggle with the initial use case. Like, okay, mm-hmm, I know I want to learn how to write code. I've gone through all the Trailhead modules. I've done the examples. I've found some stuff online, but I need to write some real code. Where do I find a real use case? Yeah. And without that real use case, like, you know, where do you start? So just having the use case, having something to start with, for me, running into bugs was a way to really dig deep into stuff. And mm-hmm, it's interesting now at almost 50, I've got a few years before I hit that milestone. But the way I think of things now versus the way I thought of things way back in the day when I was writing code, like, it's just, it was the same way our brains worked going through. I went through the public school system. It was all about memorization. You memorize how to do stuff. Mm-hmm. So I memorized syntax and I memorized, it was kind of like how GPT works now. Like I was kind of, you know, I was a transformer just trying to figure out what came next. And eventually I figured it out on some level, but there was no meaning to it. So now going back and learning the meaning behind these structures and how to apply them, you know, this, again, it's, when you are starting out, you need those use cases to point you in different directions. And mm-hmm, you don't really want to try to go down a specific direction when you have no idea, you know, what any path leads to. But finding that use case, finding that driver, just, you know, something pukes on you, cool, let's go in and fix it and you know, tear it apart. And that's like you're describing, you can't break it. So tear it apart, let's reassemble it, learn how this stuff works. And then over time, you just figure out, wow, human beings really all kind of think in similar ways. So mm-hmm, the way that this computer that I ripped apart in school because I was allowed to do so and reassemble it, it actually conceptually works the same way a computer program does. It's got these different components, these different modules. How do they all come together? And you start to kind of develop this really modular thinking and you start to learn how to break down these different structures of how humans apply thinking. And you, this is where you start to get into architectural thinking. This is when I sit mm-hmm down to design a system, when I sit down to design an application, really all architecture is, all design is assembling pieces. So when you ripped apart the computer, you saw it had a CPU. You saw it had, I'm trying to think of the computing architecture back then, like, you know, an 8086 processor or, you know, whatever you were ripping apart at the time. Like it had different components that came together on a motherboard to serve specific purposes. Now we're in a digital world where we're talking about stuff where it's like, I don't know if this is real or tangible or if it's just, you know, a digital concept, but we're still reassembling things in that way. So breaking things apart, tearing things down and rebuilding, great way to learn. Yeah. You just have to have that starting point.
This is totally adjacent, but I just love the visualization that, like, if you popped open a Commodore 64, I think I did at one point, and my reaction was, what's all this empty space? You know, what's this motherboard doing that doesn't end? And then I think about, like, putting together my niece's MacBook Pro, mm-hmm, where you have to, like, dig through four layers of hardware, you know, just to, like, flush out the hard drive and put it back together.
Well, it was like when you used to be able to maintain your own car, right? Because you can pop the hood and you knew where everything was. Now with modern cars, you don't want to do that because probably it'll void your warranty, number one. But number two, I just wouldn't know where to find anything. Same thing with computers. Like that Commodore was like, there's a bunch of ribbons in there. It's like, what do these stupid ribbons do? Exactly. You follow them back to these pins that are, you know, soldered onto the motherboard. It's like, what does all this stuff do? And again, I didn't really learn unless I had a reason to learn. So, You know, I would dumpster dive for old computers and modems. That's how I got online. Was I would dumpster dive for 1200 baud modems so that I learned how to use serial line internet protocol, SLIP, so that I can get on the internet in the early days. Like, this is, you know, this is all fascinating to me. And now today, like, looking back on that and how primitive those technologies were, you know, but how cool they seemed and how advanced they seem at the time, like where we are right now as a society, or and then, you know, just as a technologist, like, what comes next? This is just like an insane period of time. Like, what do we get to do next? Just from the primitive beginnings to where we are now, we've just come so far, done so much cool stuff. What do we do next?
Yeah. Did you ever run a BBS?
I did run a BBS. Oh, man. Commodore 64 BBSs. I'll give some shout outs. Jester's Court was a big one because back then I got busted because, like, I would go on BBSs super late at night so that, you know, my mom wouldn't pick up the phone and hear the modem buzzing sound. But I got busted because I didn't realize there was like A band, B band, C band, and D band calls. This was Ameritech back then, which, you know, through probably 30 acquisitions is now part of AT&T. And all of a sudden, my mom brings me this like, you know, 2-inch thick phone bill. And all these BBSs that I'd been calling in like Wheaton, Illinois, like that I didn't realize was so far from Cary, Illinois. I was like, oh man, those were expensive calls. So, I got busted. So I then had to really focus on A-band BBSs. So I found a couple of those, and then I volunteered to be the sysop.
Sysop.
And so I was the sysop of Jester's Court and a couple other BBSs. And then I actually got connected with a guy who was running a BBS. This was a more mature BBS. This was not like a Commodore 64. This was, you know, we were in the IBM days now, kind of pre-internet. And, you know, this dude ran a really cool BBS called Cloud City Online. And, you know, just again, just because I like working on this stuff, I volunteered to be sysop and got really involved in it. And this was right around the time the commercial internet was becoming a thing. And we actually turned that BBS into what you would call an ISP now. It was like, you know, 1200 baud modems, or, you know, 45K modems, whatever it was at the time. And all we were doing was routing people to the public internet. And funny story, this guy actually had the domain name cloud.com, which, you know, imagine today would be worth bazillions of dollars. And looks like it just kind of expired and somebody else picked it up. But
that's too much.
BBS to internet transition was just a huge, huge, huge moment in my life. Mm-hmm. And everything after that point was all internet all the time.
Well, and to me, I think that was the first time I had to, like, being a BBS user is one thing. Like, it's a series of menus. You go in, there's a series of menus. But being like a sysop and actually hosting a BBS, like, you actually kind of need to understand, like, going back through those, you know, figuring out the modular parts, you kind of have to understand how it works or you're not going to get it up and running.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even within that, you got to figure out what people want to use. Like, do they want to use the discussion board? So some BBSs, people were active on the discussion boards, and that was kind of the niche, the MO of that particular BBS. Some of them were about downloads. Like, we were downloading pirated Commodore 64 software all the time. Like, that was what we used it for. And then eventually, you know, IBM software, but, you know, that, or DOS, right? Like DOS programs. Mm-hmm. But that's what the BBSs were there for. That's what we use them for. So as a sysop, you had to learn how all these different components work, but you also had to understand just what people wanted to do with all this stuff. Because I remember on one BBS, I tried to resuscitate the message boards and people just didn't use them. All of a sudden, they got flooded with all these feeds from all these different BBSs that they didn't want to see. And they yelled at me as the, you know, the head sysop. And that was like my first experience with like bad user experience.
Bad user, right.
I've been cognizant of UX since that point forward.
Nice. Well, so I think you've been kind of describing it, but like how, because you started out more purely in development, right? Like, how have you kind of gone from a developer to just kind of more formally an architect?
The long and winding road.
Okay. As
Sir Paul McCartney would say. If you look at my career, and I had to look at my career when I was putting together my resume last year, and what I found was, number one, you can't stick 30 years on a 2-page resume. I'm sorry. What anybody tells you is just not possible. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at all the different stuff that I've done and trying to break it down into, again, modules, components, because that's what I do. And what I found interesting about my career was I bounced around and did a bunch of different stuff in a bunch of different technical domains just because I wanted to master it, wanted to learn it. Gotcha. So I started out writing basically script language programs, basic, didn't really go beyond that. I got into HTML, writing web pages, CSS when it came out, JavaScript. So my first real IT job was building web pages. It was one of the first commercial websites for this bank in the North Shore of Chicago here. And so I did write code, but again, I was always trying to find new ways of doing things, new ways of applying what I do. So at that point, I was kind of bored with just, you know, writing web content. I was bored with all the stuff I'd done before, which is more like network connectivity. So in that aspect, I had been a network architect for some period. I started out with token ring networks before we even had Ethernet. Like, I did that. And now networking is, you know, it's a commodity, right? It's on the wider scale of things, it's not where I wanted to be. So then I moved more into servers, right? And we went from Novell to Windows, and I learned Windows NT, and it's like, okay, I kind of like this Windows stuff. So I got into NT, I got into messaging, so I became a messaging architect. And really, the architect piece of all this was just designing the system and maintaining the system, right? I didn't do a lot of builds. I either had people who did the builds for me, or it was part of my purview. But as I grew in my career, I found myself just building more and more complex systems until I finally got to Siebel Systems in late 90s, early 2000s, which, you know, the early precursor to what became Salesforce, because all of our executives ended up at Salesforce at some point. But, you know, we get to that point, and I've realized I've worked on networking, I've worked on infrastructure, I've looked out into the data center to see, you know, hey, look at all these machines with their green and blue blinking lights. This is awesome. I wanted to do more and more and more and more. So I started to get closer and closer to the application architect level, where it's taking enterprise applications, it's taking software, it's taking custom code, and now going out and releasing that into the enterprise, running your business on that type of software. So Siebel afforded me that opportunity to move into the enterprise, move into enterprise applications. I managed a portion of the internal implementation of Siebel. I managed a portion of PeopleSoft, right? I had my hands in a lot of different places, and I started to see all these different connections between the infrastructure piece, between the networking piece, between the server piece, and now applications and programming languages. So it just kind of set me off in a bunch of different directions. But what ended up happening was, at Siebel in the early 2000s, I just reached a point where I became bored with technology, or at least I became bored with answering questions sounding like an IT guy. So when the business would come and say, hey, we're looking for a system that'll do A, B, and C for us, the default response was something like, well, how many servers do you need? And it was, we were not speaking the same language, and that frustrated me to no end, because I just wanted to take what they needed and build something, right? Again, apply technology to make their lives easier. And that's where I kind of pivoted more into business process design and business architecture, because I had been influenced by a number of authors. I had gone to see a number of seminars in the early 2000s that were focused on business process reengineering and getting involved in that concept. And I was able to take the technical skills and now apply them to the business process and business workflow side of things, understand how businesses work conceptually, break that down into the individual components, just like I would a computer program or a computer system. And it started to make sense. All this stuff started to make sense at a very high, holistic level across an enterprise. And I started using the term enterprise architect probably 15 years ago, before I even got heavy into the Salesforce space, because that's I saw, right? It was the marriage of business and technology to create that alignment.
Yeah. So speaking of, how did you first get introduced to Salesforce?
So Salesforce, if you're familiar, there was this show on HBO back in the day called The Sopranos. Not many people have heard of it.
It's a tiny indie gig, I think. Yeah.
And actually, Little Steven is here in Chicago this week at Wrigley Field, part of the E Street Band, but I digress. But there, Little Steven had that role, or he was Tony's right hand, the consigliere, right? If I butcher that, I apologize. But he said, I try to get out and they pull me back in. He was quoting a movie. I try to get out, they pull me back in. And something about that line just stuck with me because with CRM, I had done CRM for so long at Siebel that I just didn't want to do CRM anymore. And I kind of go on these 3-5 year cycles. I'm like, I just don't want to do CRM anymore. And so I tried to get out. And then again, you know, I tried to get out and I got pulled back in. And how I got pulled back in was I was kind of sucked into this idea of this early concept of platform as a service. This was the early days of the cloud where it's like, hey, I could build little modules of business logic and then assemble them into applications that, you know, small, mid-sized enterprises can use to automate pretty, you know, mundane tasks like, you know, payroll processing or, you know, just accounts payable, accounts receivable, just the basic bones of a business that had been kind of neglected from the perspective of having a space in the cloud. This is before we had Workday and apps like that. To bridge that gap, I started working with a number of platforms, Coghead being one of them. Coghead was this beautiful declarative platform that had programmatic capabilities, and you could build these kind of bespoke applications. And I got back into not necessarily programming, but building stuff through Coghead. And then Coghead, that's where I kind of got reintroduced to a bunch of people from my past, somebody from Siebel who wanted to build a marketing application. And we explored Coghead as an option for that. We explored, I mean, building a Java application on a Tomcat server. Like, we there was nothing. There was nothing out that could do what we wanted to do. And this was truly, we had an idea and we had no way to implement it. So my friend who I worked with at Siebel then went to work for Salesforce. And it was one of those, you know, pulling me back into the space things. And I got involved with the Force.com platform. I started doing implementations, migrations from early CRMs. And then I was there at the right time, right? They introduced workflow rules, approval processes, all the things we take for granted now. Those were all new things at one point. And then in 2000, whatever it was, 7-ish, the Apex language comes out, and then Visual Force comes out after that. And for me, from an intellectual perspective, just the ability, I was like a kid in a sandbox. Just the Force.com platform coupled with Apex, which I think is the most beautiful programming language in the world, as much as I don't get to use it anymore, it just really tied a lot of concepts together that I had struggled with to build these composed, bespoke applications. And the Force.com platform brought it all together. So, you know, there was an event, again, pre-COVID, like I can't keep years straight, but late 2000s, there was an event at Moscone Center, Tour de Force. And it was kind of like the coming out party for the Force.com platform. And from that point on, I was hooked.
Yeah.
So, you know, fast forward, I've been doing this now 16, 17 years. And that early evolution of the platform was just, that was so fun to be a part of. Just the rate of growth, just the rapid rise of Salesforce as a company was an absolute blast. And then later on, as I got less and less involved in the hands-on part of things, I got recruited by Don Robbins, who everyone knows. And Don, you know, if you know anything about Salesforce, Don has probably tried to recruit you to teach. Don recruited me to teach, successfully recruited me after years of trying. And towards the end of my tenure with Salesforce, I was doing a lot of teaching. I was doing a lot of content writing. I was doing a lot of certification work, writing certification questions, grading the advanced developer certification exam when it was still, you know, like a week-long code project. So it's been this long, fun ride. And I think it's been a fascinating ride because I've gotten to watch a lot of cycles kind of come and go over the years. But now here we are at this brand new intersection of just everything we know from just the perspective of human history and human society. All this stuff doesn't matter now because we have AI. And I think you know something about AI. I think I may have seen a session you did at Forcelandia back in July. You know, where does AI take us now? Like CRM, right. Great, cloud, great. Here's AI. What comes next?
I have to say your feedback, you came up to me after the keynote. One of my favorite reviews of anything I've ever spoke. You're like, wow, I was really excited about AI until you got to the dark stuff.
Which we all are. And it's
which we all are.
It was the quickest.
We should be to a certain extent, right?
Well, we should be super excited. We should be like, hey, this is awesome. But like the hype cycle for like after ChatGPT, GPT-3.5, like, got people's attention. And then GPT-4 was like, what just happened to us? And for me, like, it just opened up just whole new ways of thinking about things, like created new pathways in my brain to finding and processing information. But yeah, the dark stuff, we have to think about that stuff. And we've always kind of ignored it in the past. I mean, the move fast, break stuff concept, it just doesn't work anymore. And especially now that I've spent as much time as I have in the enterprise, which does not move as fast as a company like a Meta or a Twitter / X / whatever Elon decides to change the name to next week. Like the enterprise doesn't move that fast. So, when I was in my early 20s and I was a punk, not that I'm not a still a punk, but when I was in my early 20s, like I just wanted to move fast. I wanted to break stuff. I didn't understand why we had structure. I didn't understand why authority mattered, right? And now that I'm getting closer to my 50s and I've seen these cycles, it's like, we need to pump the brakes on this because there's the dark stuff you talked about, right? Like if we make wrong choices now, it's going to have long-term implications on our future as a species. But then there's the other side of it, which is it's been fascinating watching the co-opting of this technology occur so quickly, where all of a sudden everybody pivoted from being a Web3 crypto expert to an AI expert overnight. Don't sleep on these 3,000 ChatGPT prompts. It's like, slow down. And that's not a safety concern. Like everybody's using GPT at this super shallow level. Okay, fine. That's not going to end society, but the other stuff where we already think at such a shallow level, we don't think about things critically. We are very responsive to stimuli. Where does AI fit into that? You know, how do we make sure that we're not, just having what we had in 2016 with the misinformation cycle, learning that was that was state actors involved in that. Now, what do state actors with AI and quantum computing, like, what does that threat look like? These threats are real and we have to think about them. But on the other hand, like, I want to think about AI as, I want to look back at 2023 and be like, hey, remember when we still had cancer? Hey, remember when we had massive income inequality and wealth inequality, and not making this a political discussion, but we'll have a much better world than we have today. Just like our world today is much better than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The growth that we're about to experience, nobody can fathom this. It's a new period of enlightenment. That's what I'm focused on. That's what I'm excited about. But we got to cover the dark stuff. You got to mitigate the risk, or at least
You gotta acknowledge it. We might not be here on the road. So it's not going to doom and gloom us right now. But you have to kind of acknowledge the risk while you're driving the car down the road. But speaking of driving the car, like how, and feel free to give like concrete examples. But like when it comes to the role of an architect, how do you think AI is overlapping with that?
AI becomes not another component in the design, in the consideration for what you design. It becomes almost like another pillar that you have to account for as this weird combination of both consumer of your system and as like your best friend that's going to help you along the way, making your life easier as you go through your personal workflows and your organizational workflows. And it's going to be there kind of like as our I don't want to use the term second brain because that has a specific meaning, but you know, it's going to be a shadow of ourselves. So the way I'm approaching AI right now from a design perspective is when you think back to kind of the triad of our stakeholders or what goes into an organization, an enterprise, it's the people, it's the processes and the technology, right? PPT, people, process, technology. Yep. Well, there's a fourth pillar now, and it's AI. And I think the thing that I'm personally struggling with is, you know, AI is not a net contributor per se. Like we're looking at AI right now strictly in generative terms. Like that's collectively, we love generative AI and that's what we're focusing on. But it goes so far beyond that. So it's like, is this blind spot going to prevent us from taking advantage of emerging technologies that maybe aren't as sexy, but have real world implications? So it's this constant, just where are we going to apply this? How are we going to apply it? But thinking of it in terms of what are the capabilities of this technology? And where I see this really coming into play, the biggest application of AI that I see as an architect designing a system, I just talked about UX, you know, a few minutes ago. From a UX perspective, things change because the human beings now, their role changes in everything. So AI comes into the picture and human beings have a dual role to play. So they are learning. They're learning their jobs. They are learning about their customers, the relationships with their customers. They're learning all the time, building up that knowledge inside of their own heads. In the meantime, AI is also learning. It is learning from data that's coming in. It's learning from other interactions with other human beings, you know, through the machine learning process. And now this intersection is that the human is going to share its knowledge with the machine. The machine is going to then refine its own knowledge and provide better knowledge back to the human. And you have to find a way to incorporate that feedback loop into every, let's say, handoff point, every possible point of friction within a process, or every point where a human has to apply some level of cognition, because at that point, that's where the true value of the AI is going to come in, because it becomes an extension of the human. So there's that aspect that you're feeding the AI with knowledge, it's feeding that back to you. You know, just in general, in enterprise architecture, we struggle with loops in general. We struggle with feedback loops. We struggle with communication loops. We struggle with loops in general. So that's a problem we have to really tackle at the enterprise level, is how do we get the loops right so that we can have positive feedback loops where there's an interaction occurring between a human and another human, a machine and a machine, or some combination of those with AI involved. And then, yes, generative, you know, really the capabilities moving forward, there are going to be some jobs that are lost by that, or at least transitioned into new types of roles. But on the bigger picture side of AI now, this is where we can now start to enforce behaviors or enforce, not necessarily enforce, enforce isn't the right word, but we can provide incentives to our users at the UX level to give them a better experience based on how their own minds work, based on how they want to interact with the system. And now instead of having to design really rigid systems that maybe account for 40 to 60% of use cases or personas, the AI through, you know, either natural language processing or just being able to interpret human thought based on, you know, past interactions is going to be able to interpret what that human's trying to do and then maybe dynamically generate UIs or, you know, generate analytics just by putting in the parameters. And you have that chat-like conversation. And that, from that perspective, is going to then allow architects to focus more on layers of abstraction where we say, okay, use your system any way you want to, use that AI any way you want to, but here is what we need for you to complete this interaction or this transaction. Here is the data we need, which is an input to another workflow or another process that then aligns to business processes, value streams, what have you. And that becomes a different type of interaction. And again, from an architect perspective, we can now start to attack a lot of complexity at those more specific levels by abstracting to just making sure that the AI is aware of our constraints. You have to provide your data in this format, make sure the human user gives you this data, do this type of validation. And now it just becomes we don't have to think about that. We don't have to spend so much time designing and building UIs, user experience, because now that's going to be handled at a certain level. So it's just really interesting to think of things multidimensionally, because you can start to see how AI is just going to take over, not take over. That's such a human way of looking at it, but it's just going to become integrated with everything that we do. And that excites me, because again, I'm not getting younger. So this technology is what I'm going to be focusing on for the rest of my career. And that makes me excited.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have had, it has nothing but a positive experience for me so far. And I still liken it, you know, when people are like, well, are you afraid that it's going to start, you know, taking over developers' roles? And I'm like, look, developers already cut and paste a lot of code. I can cut and paste code from Stack Overflow. I can cut and paste code from a ChatGPT prompt. Like there's speed and efficiency differences here. But when it came to like, how did I learn things? The overall flow is not all that changed. Now, to flip that script a little bit, what kind of role do you think an architect has when it comes to designing things for humans in terms of things like a human's work day and a human's stress level and, you know, the brain of the human and the mental health of the human?
So this is something that I've spent way, way, way too much time thinking about. I've had a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you,
it's one of the benefits of nearly turning 50.
If you ever have the opportunity to take, let's say, 6 months off and just drop out of society and just think, do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, not some of the things, but I started to see a very clear connection between how humans think and how they interact with systems. That's not anything new. That's not a novel concept, but it was with a previous employer, and the way that these users interacted with the system was like nothing I had ever seen, because they just didn't have the time or the attention span to sit and look for something for more than half a second. Like it had to be instantaneous because that was just it. They had to go back to whatever the previous task was. There was no concept of context switching when you had to be hyper-focused on something for a period of time during the day. So from that perspective, I viewed that as my responsibility as the architect to find a way for those users to interact with my system in a way that was meaningful to them, but also gave me what I wanted, which was their knowledge, right? So you had to kind of design this, and this was a securities trading firm. So I kind of looked at it from the perspective of a trade. You know, when you trade something, you are trading something of value and you are getting something of value in return. What am I giving up in value here as the architect? Well, I'm not giving anything up. Actually, what I'm going to do for you is, remember that previous form that took about 10 seconds to fill out because there was like 8 fields on there that didn't matter? Check out this shiny new one. Isn't that awesome? There's only 4 fields you have to fill out. Doesn't it look better? And they're like, wow, that's actually really cool. I'm going to use that. And then they use it. And that one piece of information that you weren't getting before that you really needed for your analytics or some downstream process, they're inputting it now because you've just exchanged a positive experience for that piece of information. And I took that to a higher level. I started thinking about the touchy-feely side of UX. You know, the stuff that, again, I'm sorry for anybody who is offended by this, but corporate employers right now, I think they're paying lip service to the touchy-feely stuff, the human mental health, the human aspect of just work in general and that relationship. I think that relationship can be made much, much better by just understanding what it is that we want out of work, what fulfills us.
Yeah.
I have the opportunity of spending a lot of time with people much younger than myself, just based on where I live in Chicago. I live in a younger neighborhood and I have a lot of interactions with people who are 15, 20 years younger than me all the time. And getting that perspective of just what people want out of the relationship with work versus the contract we had when we were that age, where it strictly was, even though it was knowledge work, it was still kind of like you put in your 40 hours a week and you know you're paid for each unit you put into it. Now, employees want to have an impact on what they do. They want their work to mean something. And I think that gets ignored, or worse yet, it gets paid lip service. And that's really, really important. And then from an emotional perspective, it's not the employer's responsibility to make sure that everybody feels good when they come to work. That's every individual's responsibility, is their own mental health. But
yeah,
on the other side of that, you know, we just have to understand that we're human, and we should be well aware of that by now after enduring the pandemic. But what can you do to make the in-person experience, the human experience, better?
Yeah.
People are concerned about their commutes right now. There are things that are, you know, they don't want to give up that time with their family that they've developed from working from home. So what is that transaction? What is that trade-off where you can help people feel good about that experience? You can help people feel good about the work they do because it's meaningful, it's impactful. They can see that. They have clear direction in what they do. That's the simple stuff, right? That's just what people want on the surface. That's not even getting into psychological safety, which you say that in open company, you'll get eye rolled, right? Psychological safety is a real thing. It's an important thing, but it's touchy-feely. Corporate America doesn't want to really pay a lot of attention to that. If they can hire a consultant to put together a program that makes it look like they've checked all the boxes, then sure, you know, they can say they're doing that. But really getting in tune with how human beings think, that was one of the biggest kind of like objectives I had for myself when I went on this intellectual wander, was how do you tie that soft, touchy-feely stuff back to making a good, positive experience for your users? And that drives everything I think about from a design perspective now. You have a contract with your users and with the owner of the system. And that contract is just make this an optimal transaction. Every time I interact with the system, just make sure it doesn't suck, right? At a minimum, make sure it's a net positive experience.
Yeah. I mean, I remember working for a large client back in my model days, and we were doing some kind of we weren't even to user acceptance testing at this point, but it was a very simple interface. But one of the project managers from the other side was like, hey, can I sit you down and show you what they're doing now? And then I'm going to show you what you built. I'm like, okay. And he did. And mine was like three more clicks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I say mine, I was just doing what I was told. But anyway, he's like, can we get this version closer to this version? And I'm like, I think so, but is two more clicks really that big of a deal? Mm-hmm. And he's like, you have to realize people use this all day long. So like going back to your example, right, like 10 fields versus four and 10 seconds versus four, whatever, however that translation is, until you put yourself into the seat of that worker and realize how much more efficient you just made their entire day, like it's hard to realize the impact you can have if you just don't care.
Exactly. Well, and then to take that a step further, this is a newer concept. There's a book that, you know, probably everybody knows about by now, but it took me a long time to read it. And it was called Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman. Super important book. But it took me, since the time it was recommended until the time I actually finished it, it took me over 10 years to finish because it was so dense. And he goes into a lot of just, you know, how the human brain works from the perspective of trying to dissect that and apply it to how we make decisions. And that thinking in itself was fascinating, but it led to other authors like Adam Grant. You know, he has a lot of great books. Think Again was his latest. He had Give and Take was a very influential book. But what these authors were doing, they were painting this picture of trying to figure out, maybe not necessarily what drives us, what motivates us, but just, you know, how we think, how we act, how we respond to stimuli. And, you know, using your example, those you know, four extra clicks or whatever it was, from an efficiency perspective, yes, they can get more work done in less time. But just think of how your brain works. Think of how four extra clicks in a repetitive process, you know, either you're going to apply robotic process automation to that, or the human beings just sitting there clicking and clicking and clicking. Mm-hmm. That's not a great experience. That's not a great emotional experience for that user.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, I did ask after Mike's favorite non-technical hobby. And well, he says he's going to do a little dance for us.
My favorite non-technical hobby. Wow, your editor's going to have to deal with about 30 seconds of tap dancing here. Actually, this sounds super strange, but I've actually gotten into collecting art lately. And not any particular type of art. I just bought a new house, and this is the first opportunity I've had to actually decorate my own house in quite a while. And I've just really enjoyed bringing back art from Puerto Rico. I live in the Puerto Rican neighborhood of Chicago, so my front room is all Puerto Rican art that I brought back from San Juan. Local artists here. I like going to art fairs now. I never did that before. I like going to craft fairs. I don't know. Maybe this is what happens in your late 40s.
I want to thank Mike for the great conversation and information. And as always, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this show, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.